bad example as far as the U.S. is concerned that a country like Venezuela can use its own resources like oil, nationalize them, and use it for the benefit of their own people. It's the danger of a good example, as Chomsky talks about.
And that wraps it up for another edition of Flashpoints. Our executive producer is Dennis Bernstein. Our roving producer and producer of Flashpoints in Espanol is Miguel Gavilan Molina. Our technical director is Mike Biggs. For more information about the show, to listen to or download archived episodes, log on to flashpoints.net or visit our SoundCloud page at soundcloud.com/flashpoints. For questions or comments about Flashpoints, you can contact Dennis at dennisjbernstein@gmail.com. Thank you for listening.
Listening to KBOO Portland.
KBOO is excited to be part of the Willamette Week Give Guide this year. When you support KBOO through Give Guide, not only does it support your favorite community radio station, it also gives you a little back in return. When you donate $10 or more, you'll get full access to hundreds of local coupons in the Chinook Book app, plus a few other goodies. Available while supplies last. So donate to KBOO on Give Guide today at kboo.fm/give. And thanks.
There's so much that we need to share. So send a smile and show you care.
Hi, everyone. I'm Karen James from Prison Pipeline. On December 21st, we'll broadcast your holiday messages to and from your loved ones in prison. Write your holiday message or record your voice using Zoom and email your message to kboppc@gmail.com. Then tune in to Prison Pipeline on December 21st to hear your holiday messages to your loved one. Again, send those written or recorded messages to kboppc@gmail.com. And from all of us at Prison Pipeline, stay safe, be well, and all the best during this holiday season.
I'm Dime Roberts, stage and studio. You're listening to music by David Ornette Cherry at davidornettecherry.com. Today's guest is Mellory Mirashrafi, and she's an up-and-coming Iranian-American theater artist. She's worked with theater companies around the country after she graduated last year from Linfield College, where she starred as Sally Bowles in the musical Cabaret. One of my favorites. She's worked as a director with Bag and Baggage Productions in Hillsboro. She's also worked as an intern at American Conservatory Theater, a dramaturg with Speakeasy Stage, Harvard Divinity School, and Fresh Ink Theater. And she also wrote an insightful essay about Middle Eastern stereotypes and representation in adaptations of Disney's Aladdin. Her newest work is debuting at Shaking the Tree Theater as part of a digital performance special called Short Flicks. And it's my pleasure to welcome Mellory to Stage and Studio. It's so good to have you here and to see you again.
Thank you so much for having me, Dime. You know, the first time I ever saw you was in a production of Cabaret.
You're kidding me.
Not kidding.
Oh, okay. Thank you. Thank you for that. Yeah, it's, well, I first I guess I remember first meeting you, though, at Linfield College when we did a very short workshop with you and other students.
Yes, yeah, while you were doing Here on this Bridge with the ISM Project.
Yeah, the ISM Project performances there. So I was just curious, too. I mean, it seemed like a really great school from my brief encounter. How was the experience at Linfield College for you?
Oh, it was great. I mean, it was nothing what I expected. You know, I went in, I did half of my undergrad as a biochemistry major. I was pre-med until my junior year, when I did a production with Bag and Baggage in 2017 called Layla and Majnun, Romeo and Juliet, that really opened me up to feeling like I could combine who I was outside the theater with who I was inside the theater. You know, we get that kind of fragmented narrative so much from first generation artists who end up changing their majors halfway through their halfway through their undergrad or at whatever point in their lives, and that was my moment for me, where I felt like I could, you know, bring my whole self into a rehearsal process, and then it was over, and Linfield was so supportive and a wonderful place to continue my education.
You said you called yourself a first generation artist. What do you mean by that?
So both of my parents immigrated to the US from Iran, and I am a dual Iranian and American citizen, and spent most of my life traveling back and forth between the two countries, and still go when I can. Right now it's much more complicated with after the sanctions and because of COVID-19. But That's what I always think of when I describe myself that way. There's no one true way, right, to describe what your connection to being a U.S. citizen is. But that's mine.
Yeah, I always get confused because I always think immigrants are first generation, and you know, like the Japanese Americans consider the Issei is the first generation, which is the immigrants. So I always think, well, who is really the first? I mean, it depends on what you want to call yourself. As far as I'm concerned, I call myself 1.5 because I was born overseas in Taiwan, and you know, we immigrated here when I was, I don't know, about 8. So, you know, it's like that halfway point for me. So, yeah, it's
1.5. I actually love that.
I'm curious, did you grow up in Oregon?
I did. Yeah, I was born in Hillsboro, which is where Bag and Baggage lives. And I grew up, did all of my schooling there. Would go to Iran over the summers for all 3 months of the summer, and then come back to Hillsboro. And I actually didn't even know that it got warm in Oregon until spending my first summer here in, I think it must have been like, I don't even, 2014, 15.
Wow. So you have very early memories of Iran.
Yes. Yeah. Yeah. I mean, I think particularly when I was very young, when I was a baby and when I was, you know, toddling, my mom's side of the family really helped take care of me, and would visit back and forth between Iran and the U.S. too, before things got significantly more complicated, particularly after 9/11, and just as, you know, tensions rose between the two countries, immigration became more difficult.
So what was your experiences? Did you have an Iranian-American community here? I mean, I pretty much grew up without community. So I'm always curious, people who, you know, who grow up here and what their experiences are like.
I really, you know, my family was my community, was my Iranian-American community in Oregon. And by that, I mean so both of my dad's siblings live in Oregon as well. And so we always had a really rich family experience, right? Celebrating all of the holidays, celebrating Nowruz together, and, you know, Yalda that's actually coming up, and Ramadan, all of these things. But it was super, super limited to my household and my family. And so in school, that was not present at all. And my brother and I were actually, I was the only Middle Eastern or Southwest Asian person that went to my high school until my brother joined my senior year. And same with same at Linfield. It was there was not really a community. When I moved to Boston to work for the Huntington Theater Company, I just finished up a year as their literary apprentice in 2020, and there I found a really, really lovely like Muslim community through a couple of different organizations like Muslim Justice League and that sort of thing. But it wasn't until really moving to Boston that I found a bigger Muslim community and Middle Eastern, Southwest Asian community. And it was jarring. It was crazy.
I bet it was actually pretty good to find that finally.
Yeah, but it was so bizarre too, because Iranian Muslims particularly, you know, are not Arab, but many of the American Muslims, many American Muslims are Arab, and many Iranian Americans are non-Muslim. And so I always thought it was really funny that wherever I found an Iranian community, there were no Muslims, you know, and wherever I found a Muslim community, there were no Iranians. And so it was still kind of an adapting process in order to get used to that and see where I fit in, right, in all of that.
Well, no peoples are monoliths, right? No cultures are monoliths, and we have to accept all the varieties because that's what we are as humans. So, yeah, but it's good to have that experience and to learn that, too. Sometimes, you know, it takes having these interactions to actually learn more about your culture.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. And just to feel like, you know, I feel like in the back of my head, I always had this inkling of like, I know I'm not the only one out there, you know? And so to have that kind of be confirmed so in full and with such a warmth was a really good feeling.
So I think this is fascinating, Mellory. I also wondered about how it's been for you, because you were traveling, you know, you mentioned several places that you've been to, like Huntington, you were there for a year, and then the pandemic hit. How has it affected you? Because I feel like, you know, your career was just on the rise, right? And then I don't know if you're doing grad school or what, but, you know, you're just fresh out of college and then this thing happens. So would you describe what it's been like for you?
Yes, it has been an absolute roller coaster. I'm immunocompromised. And so COVID has had a huge impact on my life, has really, you know, has limited me even more than you know, the typical citizen. And so what's really funny, though, is that throughout the very beginning of COVID, I had planned a 4-day vacation from Boston to Los Angeles before any travel restrictions came down, back when it was just something that people were whispering about. And when I flew to LA, the third day that I spent there, all of the travel restrictions in California came down all of a sudden. Because if you'll remember, it was like there was nothing, and then it was everywhere. And I was so afraid of traveling that I got stranded in LA for 2 months with a carry-on and had to do all of the rest of my... And the people at the Huntington were so generous to me, and, you know, they weren't going into work. And so I just stayed there and reported 3 hours earlier than everyone else to do the rest of my apprenticeship online, digitally, the same way that everyone else was. And then had to move out of my apartment in Boston and back to Portland. So I found myself in a situation where I was doing way, way too much traveling that I was comfortable with. You know, when I finally got back to Portland, I quarantined from my family in the same house, which is a whole ordeal. Ultimately for the best, because, you know, we're taking all the necessary precautions and testing, and haven't left the house since. So, you know, other than for essential runs, but it was extremely chaotic that first couple of months.
Yeah, there was a lot in the news, especially in the early days of the COVID-19 pandemic, about how difficult it was for younger people, younger generations, to do social distancing. Has that been very, I mean, I can imagine that, you know, especially when you're used to having a lot of friends and, you know, a lot of a social life. You know, some people do have a social life. I don't, but I'm just thinking, especially when you're younger, social life is very important. So can you describe how difficult it is for younger people?
Kind of you to assume that of me. I think you're making me out to be so much cooler than I am. But
okay, it's those people that, you know, don't do the social distancing.
Theoretically, I had a bubbling and bursting social life and no shortage of things to do. it impacts every part of your life, you know, and I think that's true of everyone. And honestly, at the end of the day, it doesn't matter, because keeping people safe is what matters to me, right? And that's going to supersede any social event that I want to go to or could have gone to. And I'm happy to do it. I'm happy to do it at the end of the day. You know, every time I ask my parents, you know, isn't it crazy that we're going through this right now? They're like, well, you know, when was the last time I was quarantining? Let's see. Well, during the Iran-Iraq war in the 80s, when they were bombing Tehran and we were living in tents, you know, on the outskirts of the city, I guess that was a little more harsh. And suddenly I have a lot more perspective. And if I can stay in my little house and have all the food that I need and be able to do work when I can and have parents generous enough to take me in right now, then that's all I need, honestly.
That is really good perspective, because if you think about people who have gone through natural disasters in this country, you know, Hurricane Katrina, I mean, there's been so many different events that have caused people to, you know, to have to shelter in place just because it was dangerous out there, you know. So I think that that's a really good perspective, especially when you hear people, I don't hear about people that just complain about it and won't do it and it restricts your freedom. It's like, well, you know, there's reasons for that. So I think I think what your parents said was really good to put it in perspective.
Yeah, I'll take a little. I'll submit a little bit of my freedom for the good of the people.
And for everybody's health. Yeah, there you go. In case you just joined us, I'm DMA Roberts, stage and studio. My guest is actor, director, dramaturg, and writer Mellory Mirashrafi. If you missed any of this show, I'll have the have it on the podcast at stageandstudio.org. I want to talk a little bit about the Arts Watch piece that you did. I'm sort of like swerving here. You know, we were talking about your Iranian American experiences, young, you know, as you growing up in Oregon, and about your family. And in the Arts Watch piece, you described about because it was about Aladdin, but it was also about you, right? How people wanted to assign you the Jasmine role when you were young, and there were like Disney princesses, I guess, at a party or something, and how you felt about that. Would you describe that?
Yeah, I started the piece that way because it's always very difficult to critique something that is simultaneously problematic and also a cornerstone part of a community's identity or the only representation that a community has, you know? And so when I think about Aladdin and Jasmine and Aladdin, my middle name is Jasmine, you know? And so my whole life when I was a kid, I kind of fell into that role despite, you know, seeing the character and being like, that I actually have nothing in common with her. And the anecdote of me at like 5 or 6 or whatever I was at a party and being assigned Jasmine and really wanting Belle kind of spoke to that assignment and like forced categorization, just based on identity overlap that that you were talking about just earlier, right? Like about how it's so important to acknowledge specific identities and not monolithic versions of those conglomerate identities.
You went through a history of how the roles were played very stereotypically and misrepresented and caricatured. And then even the live action, it was about the evolution to the live action feature that happened.
In the Broadway production, there were 0 Middle Eastern people in the cast, 0 Southwest Asian people in the cast, very few on the design and directorial side. And if you look at the production photos, there are people in blatant Arab face, right? Blatant brown face with the archetypal arch eyebrows and the fake beard and mustache playing villains, right? And so I looked at that and then the new live action version that has more people of color in the cast, has more Middle Eastern, Southwest Asian people in the cast. And on the production team,
but still manages to kind of favor this monolithic, quote unquote, diversity, right, over over specificity and representation necessarily. And so that was kind of what I was looking at and weighing what that means and what the drawbacks and benefits are, right, of seeing Middle Eastern people in the Aladdin storyline for the first time as someone of that culture and general identity. And being able to look at the screen and say, oh, this is a kufiya, this is a turban, this is a hijab. But knowing that most of the people who are watching the movie are not necessarily going to be able to make those distinctions. And so what does that do to an audience, right? To see all of those presented in the same fictional city, in the same fictional part of the world. And does that help more or hurt more? And I think, I don't know.
And, you know, a lot of times, too, it isn't just Aladdin, right? A lot of times when a work that is being reinvented, let's say like a Shakespeare play or a Greek play, and then it's set in, you know, this exotic place, you know, I've seen that a lot with Asian material especially. And I'm wondering, you know, what are some of the more troubling concepts for you that you've seen or experienced employing Middle Eastern, Persian, or West Asian themes, especially for theater?
Anytime that you are setting something in the quote unquote Middle East writ large, that's like, it's like saying you're going to set something in Asia, right? It's the biggest continent. And there are...
What does that mean exactly? Right. Where is it? Right.
Right, exactly. Which country specifically? Even if you say which country, those borders were not drawn by the people who lived on that land. And so which culture, which ethnic group, which religion? And so, you know, and on and on. And so where I find that it runs into the most problems is not necessarily even when there's this kind of straightforward villainous or, you know, archetypally harmful depiction, but when it comes through in the good intent of white theater makers, when it comes in through the good intent of quote unquote Western productions, that to me is where I end up feeling like it's the most secretly hurtful, because it's being presented as a positive thing. And I've run into that many times, you know. And Aladdin, you know, is a perfect example of that, as is, you know, anything that you superimpose onto a different place in the world without the origins of that piece being of that place. The Shakespeare production thing is also the perfect example of that. It's like we're doing Taming of the Shrew on the Silk Road. Like, where?
Yeah, there's a fine line between exploitation and honoring. You know, there's...
Yeah, exactly.
It's not that fine of a line, actually, but there's a big line, actually.
Yeah, it's kind of a, you know, kind of a thick line, almost like a border.
But, yeah, so I guess, you know, that's probably where your love of dramaturgy might have come from.
Exactly. Yes, yeah, that's spot on. And kind of, you know, noticing for the first time that the language comes from somewhere and that you can bring people in to create new language. And language, you know, being kind of a catch-all for physicality, for, you know, written language, for adaptation, for, you know, all of these different modes of communication that we use in theater. And that is where so much of the gatekeeping power is held, right? And I always say that dramaturgy is like what an art curator does, but for theater.
Thank you for that explanation of dramaturgy. I really appreciate that and that perspective. In case you just joined us, I'm Dimay Roberts, Stage and Studio. My guest is actor, director, dramaturg, and writer Mellory Mirashrafi. I would like to hear what you think should happen regarding that representation as your career grows. You know what? And we're going to talk about the piece that you just did for Shaking the Tree. But what would you like to see happen regarding depictions of your culture, especially?
Well, in regards to my specific culture, right, Iranian / Iranian-American diaspora, Iranian-Muslim culture, I mean, I'd like to just see more, right? And I think that starts with kind of these asks, right? Like speaking of Shaking the Tree, right? And what it usually takes is someone reaching out and saying, we'd like to hear from you, and giving space, time, funding to a specific vision and to a specific story. And I think that comes with so much intentionality. So I'd like to see that. And I also would like to see more resources and more guides to where to find this kind of work specifically. I have recently been doing some work on a database called the Digital Guide to the Middle East that has international and national / diaspora synopses to plays written by Middle Eastern and Southwest Asian artists. And that kind of archival work and categorizational work is really exciting to me and a really good place to get people in touch with work like this. Because I think so often the question is, well, where do I find it?
Well, and one of the places you find is doing it yourself, right? So right. you recently adapted a Persian and Kurdish story. You directed a Syrian-American actor, which is awesome, Paige A. Hanna, to perform it for a film. And I'm just really curious, why did you choose this particular piece to do? And, you know, what was the importance for you?
Well, Shaking the Tree reached out to me and said, we're thinking of doing some scary stories, some ghost stories with that are tied to specific cultures. And we're thinking of turning them around in a week. And I said, great, sounds great, right? And what I did was, well, first of all, I looked at what community I had in the close area, right? And so Paige is a wonderful first-generation immigrant Syrian-American actress and musician and just all-around talented person. And I reached out to her, and so she and I started talking about what a scary story with a kind of quick turnaround might look like. And so obviously we both immediately asked our dads and said, what kind of scary stories were you told? What kind of demons and ghosts do you remember? And, you know, asked and notated and reported back to each other. And both had this depiction of a kind of like sea monster-y, snaky, underground creature, right? And it looked kind of different for each of us, but a definite through line. And so I started doing research from there. This is where the dramaturg in me comes in, right? Did a bunch of research and found the story of Shah Maran, who is the queen of the serpents, and the story that we ended up going with. Shah means king, or in this case, you know, ruler, monarch, and Maran means snakes in Farsi. And the more I researched, the more I was surprised that I kept finding the source of this story being reported as Turkish. You know, it would say, this is a Turkish story, this is a Turkish story. And I was really surprised by that, not only because of the linguistics and the etymology of the character itself, the story itself, but also because it predated, you know, the Turkish migration into Anatolia by so much. And so So we looked it up even more and learned that the story was originated in the Mardin province of Turkey that is currently home mostly to the Kurdish population of Turkey, a population that is heavily discriminated against and, you know, typically pushed to the corners of whatever country they're inhabiting. And Syrians in Turkey, along with Yazidis and even more, right? And probably other ethnicities and religions as well, you know, particularly before the Armenian genocide, right? And so that was so interesting to me because what that meant, right, is that these stories have been repackaged into Turkish ones. And that really tracked for me, like the direct impact of colonization, the direct impact of pan-Turkism on the cultural memory of both a land and a people through the telling of this story. So in adapting it, it was so fascinating to me and so meaningful to both me and Paige, right, to have a story performed by a Syrian person and written and directed by a Persian person that to me represents the kind of reclamation of and acknowledgement of the like indigenous roots of the story, as well as a separation from this kind of like colonized narrative of it being a Turkish tale, even though it is residing in and famous in the modern Turkey.
Well, you mentioned that it's a scary story, and I saw it, and it's lovely. I mean, it's beautifully shot, but I also can see the creepiness in it because she's in this bathtub, and we don't know exactly why, and she's reciting this story. So I think you accomplished a lot of things, and thank you for that explanation too.
You know, the content of the story, without giving it away too much, presents a situation, right, in which a person indigenous to the land, Shahmaran, Queen of the Serpents, is taken advantage of and destroyed at the hand of imperialism. That's exactly what happens in the story.
I want to make sure that people know that Mellory's film Shahmaran is part of Short Flicks, an online series of digital shorts at Shaking the Tree Theater, and it's running online through January 10th on their website. Also showing is Matter by famed playwright Idris Goodwin, and it's directed by James Dixon. Also in the Short Flicks is Flying Head Down, the story of Nukekubi, a Japanese folktale, and it's a film adaptation by Rebbe Ewer Foster. And all three are online until January 10th at shaking-the-tree.com. And I'll have that at stageandstudio.org as well. What's ahead for you? We've got a couple minutes left here, Mellory. It's going to be a strange holidays. You mentioned your family earlier. What are you looking forward to?
I'm mostly looking forward to on the 20th is Yalda, which is what my family celebrates. You know, we don't really do the Christmas holiday, but it is the solstice celebration. We make a little altar, we eat pomegranates, and we recite poetry, and it's kind of a celebration of making that longest night of the year a little lighter. Work-wise, I have an upcoming publication in the Methuen Drama Book of Trans Plays. I wrote an introduction to Raphael Khoury's Shihi Mi, which is a lovely play about three Southwest Asian and Muslim trans people. And so I wrote an intro to that that should be coming out in the next year or so. And I'm working on an audio play called Abundancia by Carlos Sena Trujillo through Matchbox Theater Company in Connecticut. So that'll be coming soon as well.
Well, good for you. It's so good to get to know you better and to have this conversation. I really appreciate the work that you're doing and the representation that you're doing. And keep it going, you know?
Thank you.
We definitely need you. It's so great to talk with you today, Mellory Mirashrafi. Thank you for this conversation. Before we go, I want to do a short shout out for Passant Art Theater. They're doing a virtual concert of holiday favorites and gospel songs, and it's happening online on Saturday, December 19th at 5:30 p.m. And Passant Art usually produces beautiful production of Black Nativity. And this year, it's Joyful Sounds, a virtual holiday concert. So check it out at passantart.org. That's it for Stage and Studio. You can hear this show again at stageandstudio.org. We're going out with more music by David Arnett Cherry. David Arnett Cherry.